Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast where I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is David Sparks. David, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Scott. I'm kind of excited to be here talking about Star Trek.
What is not to love about talking about Star Trek?
Exactly.
Unless you don't
And not only that, Deep Space Nine.
I love Deep Space Nine. Oh, I have said many times, my favorite series, and I think the episode we're going to talk about, which is A Time to Stand, Season 6, season premiere, actually, sums up many of the reasons why I love Deep Space Nine, and many of the reasons why it will be very difficult as I get many more episodes for Random Trek to talk about Deep Space Nine. We will delve into that.
It's like the Game of Thrones version of Star Trek.
That's right. It's where the writers suddenly realized, we can have multi-episode arcs, which is great, except if you have a podcast where you pick random episodes to watch.
Well, also, I mean, it's just got it's got multiple interests and parties. I mean, so much of the early Star Trek was, you know, Klingons versus the humans, or, you know, it was very simple in terms of the conflict. And in Deep Space Nine, there's like all these different groups, and they all have good reasons for what they're doing, even though you may not agree with them. And they have, you know, shifting alliances. I don't know. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, and that's another thing that I love about Deep Space Nine is the depth that they give all the stories and all the characters. And there's a lot of growth, right? I mean, I love The Next Generation, but as I said countless times, there's not a whole lot of growth with the characters from Season 1 to Season 7. There's a little bit, but not a lot. But before we get into that, David, tell me, do you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
I do, and that's going to have some conflict because I am, first and foremost, and Scott, please just restrain yourself. I am a huge, huge Star Wars fan.
Oh, dear.
I was 8 years old. I went into that theater in 1976, and I bonded to the Force like a little ducky to its mama. I mean, I don't know. It just pushed all my buttons, and so much so that I was initially – scoffed at Star Trek because, you know, I grew up, I was a kid of the 70s and early 80s. And so, you know, we didn't have a lot of available media. So every time you turned on TV, Star Trek was on, but it wasn't Star Wars. So I wasn't interested.
That's true. Star Trek is not Star Wars.
And Star Wars had, you know, the production values. It was just amazing, the stuff they did in those movies. And I know now you look at it and you're like, eh, but believe me, back in the 70s, that stuff was amazing. And, So I really just got hooked up in Star Wars for so long. And then later in life, I was in law school, of all places. And, you know, I was a scholarship kid and I was broke. So I knew I had to, like, really bust it out to keep that scholarship. So all I did for, like, several years was study and go to school. But every day I would want to take a break at dinner time. And very early in my law school career, I realized that Star Trek The Next Generation was in syndication. I mean, it was still actually in active production, but they had it in syndication as well. And it was on at 7 o'clock every night. And I got in the habit of every night I would, you know, cook my top ramen and sit there at a TV tray and watch an episode of The Next Generation. And Captain Picard got me through law school. That's all I can say. I am a huge fan of The Next Generation as a result.
Well, that makes perfect sense to me. And you know, I give Star Wars a tough time. But I do like Star Wars. I am a Star Wars fan.
Yeah.
I mean, Star Trek to me is kind of like my home fandom, right? I love Star Trek.
Yeah.
I like Star Wars. And I think even, you know, the first three chronological, in real world chronology, the first three Star Wars movies are amazing pieces of science fiction. And they
stand
up.
They made, right?
Exactly.
That's three.
You are a true Star Wars fan. And they are, even, you know, if you don't watch the, you know, George Lucas special effects remastered, whatever, versions.
Wait, they remastered them?
No, you only watch it on Laserdisc, right? That's the pure...
Yes, I'm a purist.
Yes. They stand up incredibly well.
I almost bought one of those, you know, Han Shot first shirts. That's how deep it runs for me. But anyway...
Well, that's the other thing I like about Star Trek, right, is that certainly it was – and this is going to sound weird, right? But it's one man's vision, much like Star Wars, right? George Lucas, it's his vision. Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry. But luckily for Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry died, which I know that doesn't sound nice. And he was a lovely man, and I don't wish ill will on anyone. But as George Lucas has proved, you have a sense of ownership over these properties, right? And you can, if you have unlimited power to tinker with it, sometimes it just doesn't work out well.
No kidding, huh? In fact, when I write tech books, and for the first couple of books I wrote were for a big publisher. And then after that, I decided to stick it to the man and start self-publishing. And my biggest fear was that I was going to have a George Lucas moment.
Oh, yes.
You know, because like when he made the original movies, he had a lot of people looking over shoulder and the studio giving him, you know, trouble and all these pressures and constraints on him. And then when he did his own thing, you know, well, he made those movies of which we shall not speak. And I was thinking, I hope I don't do that when I go out on my own and start like doing my own books, because I could see myself delighting myself to no end and making completely terrible books. But fortunately, that didn't happen. But I was actually worried about it.
You dodged a bullet. And that we jumped right into Star Trek talk, and I didn't even ask you to introduce yourself. So quickly, or not so quickly, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself so that they'll know where to find your work. And I'm sure many of them are already familiar with you. But
I'm a nerd, you know, like the rest of us. And I like to talk about things like Star Wars and Star Trek. I'm a little solo lawyer in Southern California. I represent a lot of little businesses and whatnot. But the reason most people know me is Max Sparky. It's a website I have, maxsparky.com, where I've been writing about using Apple technology for years. And I write books. And I do a podcast with Katie Floyd called The Mac Power Users. And I just have a really great time doing that stuff. And so if you just go to maxsparky.com, you can find out all that about me.
And you should. And buy his books.
Yes, please. Because, I have a child in college. Help me.
Buy multiple copies of this man's book, please. Great. So we got that out of the way. I apologize for skipping over it. I was just – you brought up Star Wars, and so that just delved us into it. So,
I know. I crossed the wires there a little bit, and I'm sorry.
It's all right. It's allowed. I welcome all fandoms.
Does everybody also know, Scott, that you have kind of a terrifying – picture in Skype? You're looking at me right now, and I feel like I just got called to the principal or something.
I don't know if everyone knows that, but I will include a picture of my picture in Skype in the show notes so that everyone
you should
can
do
see
that. It's exactly how I imagine you looking at me when I said I like Star Wars.
It is kind of a bemused, shocked face that I have on. But I was thinking, because the last few episodes I've asked people, Do you consider yourself a Star Trek fan? Which is not, of course, a requirement to be on this program. And they have answered, well, I really like Doctor Who. So I wasn't sure if you were going to go with the Star Trek
or
the
Doctor Who. I do like Doctor Who, too. I don't know. I'm a man of many loyalties. I don't know how you can – I mean, like, Doctor Who and I, we get along just fine. I haven't watched the most recent season, so I don't want to go off on that tangent yet. But I will say I consider myself a Star Trek fan. And even though when I was a kid, I shunned it. Like I said, it got me through law school. And I really grew attached to the Star Trek, the Next Generation cast and the stories that they did. Not so much the movies, but I like the stories. And then, you know, and that momentum carried me right into Deep Space Nine and Voyager. And then I ran out of gas. So I don't know what happened after that. I know they had the one with Scott Bakula. But
they did.
I never watched that. And honestly, I don't know. There may have been another series after that. And I just don't know.
Scott Bakula, Enterprise killed the series.
Yeah. Hopefully they'll do it again at some point. But,
I hope so.
Yeah.
My theory is that they're going to relaunch, and I think this is a widely held theory on the internet, that they're going to have a series that's in the J.J. Abrams rebooted universe. We'll see if that happens or not. But
I mean, it would make sense. I mean, that's the current thing. And people that are, you know, younger now, that's the only really Star Trek they know.
Exactly. And you could probably get some cameos from the folks from the movies for tie-ins, and it would be great.
I went back. I was channel surfing the other day, and they had the Star Trek. I forget which one it was. It was the one where they had the little colony, and Data was
Star
was invisible.
Trek Insurrection, I believe.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty bad.
That is
pretty bad.
Not a good movie.
Yeah, I don't know.
That is also
First Contact, I was down with that. I remember going to see that one. But anyway, so I'm a Trekkie. Heck yeah. And we actually had Rod Roddenberry on our show once to talk about geeky Mac stuff. And And I was telling him, you know, it's just really amazing that, you know, his father built this thing that so many of us are passionate about. And it really did. I mean, I joke about it, but that, you know, in a time in my life where all I did was work, that 1 hour a day to escape to an interesting place that showed hope for the future, mm-hmm. I am very appreciative of that.
And that's the best science fiction, not just the best Star Trek, that the best science fiction transports you to a different world and lets you forget about what's going on. The best entertainment, even. Why just limit to science fiction, right? Let you, you know, takes you to a different place. And the great thing about Star Trek is that generally that place is a future that is hopeful and better than our current future. But yet then we get Deep Space Nine.
But, you know, it's funny. When you said that, I was just thinking because I have a teenage kids and all of the teenage, like, you know, future science fiction stuff now, it's all horrible. I mean, in terms of, like, dystopian, you know, people are shooting at each other, people are hunting each other, whatever it is. I mean, there's, like, 16 variations of a theme here. But it seems like every science fiction movie I watch with my kids doesn't portray the future in that manner.
Yeah, I don't know what is up with the current trend for dystopian views of the future and zombies and all kinds of disaster movies. I think it must speak to our current culture's anxieties
or something. My theory is that because there was so much success with Hunger Games that they just started, you know, pooping out copies.
Well, that is also probably true. Because I think all of the, especially the young adult dystopian novels and movies follow a very similar blueprint that can be found in the Hunger Games.
And Scott would know, because I listen to Incomparable and you read every book.
I read a lot of books. I don't really like young adult books, mostly because they're always the same story. And certainly now in vogue, they are the same story with, you know, people getting hunted down and killing, which I don't mind. But you read it once, you don't need to read it 18 times. I get it. You're a special kid. You're fighting against society that's out to get you. You will gather
usually allies. An orphan.
You're an orphan because your parents were killed in the quickening or whatever. Now, so we are not here to talk about dystopian science fiction novels, although it is an interesting topic. We're going to talk about Deep Space Nine in particular, which is, I have said on many occasions, my favorite Star Trek series. Now, would it be appropriate for me to say that The Next Generation is your favorite Star Trek series?
Yeah, I mean, Next Generation was there for me when I needed it, but I did go through – I watched the whole DS9 series all the way through, and it was actually kind of rough going for me at the beginning because it was jarring for me. You know, there was a certain kind of, you know, rhythm to a Star Trek episode in Next Generation. Now, having gone back and watched the original series, I'd say that there was a rhythm to that too. Deep Space Nine was, you know, this this Game of Thrones thing where very early the writing was complex. There was multiple interests. And I wasn't sure that's exactly what I wanted from a Star Trek series. And but I stuck with it, and I eventually got kind of hooked in. And I think another problem I had with it from the very beginning was Sisko. I just didn't like him. The very first episode, he was, you know, ripping into my favorite captain. And so personally, I didn't like him. And the way the actor, I forget his name.
Now I'm blanking on his name. Avery Brooks.
Avery Brooks played him was very wooden at the beginning. But then as the show developed, I really kind of came to appreciate the way he portrayed him, because then you got to meet his son and his father, and you got to see him that he's this guy who's got this he's got emotion that's barely contained, which I don't think is that easy as an actor to portray. And looking back, I think he did a pretty good job of that.
Yeah. I think Sisko may be, well, Captain Picard is my favorite captain, just because, as I said on one of these – or someone else actually said on one of our previous episodes that he's kind of like, you know, your dad. You want to – you look up to him. You want to make him happy. He always knows what to do. So Captain Picard is who I'd want to serve on if I were serving on one of these ships, or serve with, I suppose. I wouldn't want to serve on Captain Picard. That's a different podcast. But Captain Sisko, I feel like, is – and this is a running – kind of opinion for Deep Space Nine in general. He is the most – he has the most facets of Captain Seas. He's complicated. He's in a difficult situation and he has to deal with things and he has to – you know, he has morals, but sometimes he has to bend those morals to get what he needs because – you know, he has the Bajorans have decided he's the emissary. He's still a Starfleet captain. He has a lot of things going on. He has all these different factions that are vying for space on Deep Space Nine. And then, of course, there's a war that he basically starts.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, I mean, looking back at the arc, I wonder how much of this was planned out. Because, you know, looking at it, you wonder, I mean, this is a pretty complex story.
It is very complex. I have to believe that very little of it was planned out from the first couple of seasons.
Yeah.
I am in the process of – my wife has not seen Deep Space Nine in order. So we're in the process of rewatching it in order.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Interesting.
So the first couple seasons certainly have – I mean, they're darker than the previous Star Treks and, you know, they're on a station, so they're not moving around. And they deal with politics and stuff that Star Trek didn't do too much of. I mean, Star Trek always has been a commentary on modern day politics, but it hasn't had politics in the show as much. And so that made it different. But the first couple of seasons didn't have much of an arc, weren't telling a grand kind of operatic story. And that has they introduced that in later seasons to great effect. So much so that when we watched this episode, my wife watched it with me. She was like, "What is going on?"
Yeah. Watch it out of order?
Yes, we did.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's rough.
And she was like, "I have no idea what's going on." But she wanted to see all the episodes leading up to it so she could figure out because it's such a compelling story.
Yeah. It's like I wrote you last night. I fell into a hole. I watched this episode and I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember that. And then I went back to season 5 and watched several of those. And then I watched several after this one. So I had like a several hour Deep Space Nine journey last night. It was great. You know, another thing that turned me off the series when it first began was the character Quark, who I felt was extremely one-dimensional when the series started. And it was almost offensive, you know. But I don't know. It just seemed like they thought we were really dumb to have a character that was like that. And but then, once again, as the series progressed, the character matured or they showed more pieces of him where by the end he was a much more complete character than the beginning.
Right. He still has his core of being kind of a scoundrel and, but he is kind of a lovable scoundrel.
Well, it's not even that, you know, lovable. It's like you see that he has different interests and it's not just about the money, you know,
right.
as the series, because for the first couple seasons, it's just like, you know what he's going to say before he even talks. And it's just kind of ridiculous. I don't know. I just found it, you know,
he was one note.
Exactly. But then like, watching, I don't know. You want to go through the episode maybe, or,
sure. Let's jump into the episode. Like I said, it's Time to Stand season 6 opener. It is a continuation of the season 6 finale. I thought it was interesting that they said a continuation and not a to be continued. And then at the end of this episode, they say it continues because season 5 ends with the Cardassians taking back Deep Space Nine after Sisko has mined the wormhole so that the Dominion can not bring more ships in. And then this starts – this first episode starts actually a 6-episode arc. That is the Dominion War, basically.
Yeah.
And so this is why I was grappling with how to deal with Deep Space Nine, because especially late season, so 6 and 7, they do these things where they have this 6-episode arc. And Deep Space Nine ends with a 9-part story. 9 episodes is the finale of Deep Space Nine, which is awesome to watch. But when you – you know, assign someone the 5th episode of a 9-part story.
it's
there's a lot of context that they might be missing.
I
feel it's hard to assign ask someone to watch 9 hours of Deep Space Nine so we can talk about it.
Yeah.
But luckily,
or doing the podcast for 9 hours.
That's true.
9 times 44, whatever.
We'd need a little bit less than 9 hours. We'd need a lot of Gatorade. This episode is not self-contained, but I think they do a good job of telling a story a part of a story that is satisfying. I mean, it ends with a kind of a cliffhanger, but it's still a whole story. They do something. And it starts with an incredibly long opener, right? I mean, Star Trek traditionally starts with, like, you know, a couple-minute teaser that sets it up. It can be goofy. It can be poignant. But it's generally short is the through line.
And I think we can credit that to the fact that it's the Series 6, Episode 1. So you've been gone for a few months. All right, now we're going to tell you what's going on and kind of establish people again.
Don't forget – a lot of stuff happened.
And they actually play a lot of the video from the season five finale with, you know, the battle at Deep Space Nine and them evacuating and all that.
And then this episode brought up so many things about Deep Space Nine that I love and that are going to be difficult. Because the other thing I love, particularly for CBS and Paramount, is that they spent obscene amounts of money, I'm sure, remastering both the original series and the Next Generation onto Blu-ray into high definition and redoing all the special effects. And it looks fantastic. They remastered all the sound. It's great. Buy the Blu-rays if you don't have them. Buy a Blu-ray player just to play these Blu-rays, which is what I did.
I believe that.
They're great. Yeah. I can't say enough about them. But watching this episode, there are several scenes where there are lots of ships kind of floating around and doing things, which looks great. I mean, it doesn't look great because it's an SD, but it's cool. And as I was watching it, I thought, man, if they are going to remaster Deep Space Nine, which I hope they do, it's just going to take so much money because they never really, maybe a couple of the TNG episodes, especially with the Borg episodes, they may have had approaching the same number of ships on the screen. But I feel like this episode and this run of Deep Space Nine, they just kind of throw starships everywhere, which is awesome. But I imagine a tall task when you're remastering it.
Yeah, I mean, there's one scene where they're out, you know. In fact, it's one of the early scenes where they've got all the ships going through space, and they're actually – one is towing one of them. And I mean, it's really kind of impressive for a Star Trek episode. You know, you're not used to seeing those kinds of pixels.
Yes, because they have a budget.
Yeah, and it's a TV show.
Exactly. You know, there's a limit to what they could do. So it's very clear at the beginning of this kind of 8-minute opener that the Federation is at war with the Dominion, and it's not going well for the Federation, which is, you know, kind of when you watch Star Trek, I can imagine some people's objection to Star Trek is that, well, the Federation always shows up. They are, you know, these good-looking people and these pretty ships, and they're always clean, and they solve problems, and they go about their business, and there's no real conflict. There's never a fear that they're in a bad position. And this kind of upends that, right? Because this is a Federation. Starfleet is on the run, especially that big scene shows a bunch of ships that are clearly damaged. We find out that a fleet has been nearly wiped out by the Dominion. Things are not going well.
Yeah, those people who think that should definitely watch this episode.
Yes, because this is not a triumphant Starfleet. They're on the run. It's great. Another thing that I love about Star Trek is the characters, the interplay between the characters. And especially as you go through seasons, as a viewer, you learn more about the characters, obviously, and that makes them more like people to you. But then the characters and the actors themselves kind of settle into their roles. And so they have their own relationships and can play up on that, right? And so you get a lot of interplay in this episode of like frazzled nerves and just exhausted people who are kind of being snippy at one another, which is not what you usually see when you're watching Star Trek.
Yeah, it's like the whole thing was kind of dark. Even the way they shoot it is dark. They're wearing kind of the gray muted uniforms at this point. And even on the starships that belong, you know, to Starfleet, everything felt like it was, you know, on the fritz, you know, the whole thing. And I thought that was cool. I mean, I don't know. It really, when you told me, hey, I want you to do a DS9 episode, and in your favor, you said, I know that you like Next Generation. You want to do one of those instead? I said, no, whatever your computer rolls, I will watch. And I didn't know how I would think about it, because the last time I saw these episodes was when they ran on network TV in 1997 or whatever. So, but you know what? They really hold up pretty well.
Yeah, and I think that's a testament to the acting and the storytelling. Because, yeah, the effects look fine, but that's not why. This episode is not like a showcase other than the mass armada of ships, which looks good, but, I mean, it's an SD, so whatever. There's a limit to how good it can look.
Another cool thing about the beginning is they kind of tell the story from Gul Dukat. You know, he's sitting there telling how, hey, the war's going really well for us. You know, we got him on the run. And the whole time, you know, we don't have to worry about spoilers here, right?
No, it's all spoilers.
I mean, yeah. So you know the whole time that, you know, that Cardassia is really basically on the leash the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like, which is, I think, a fascinating thing about this proud, you know, race that all of a sudden they've agreed to become the lapdogs of these, you know, interveners from another galaxy just so they can win.
Well, that speaks to – and Gul Dukat is one of my favorite Deep Space Nine characters just because of his depth of lunacy and delusion. The actor who plays him, I mean, they couldn't have found a more perfect person to play Gul Dukat because he's clearly – he's under a ton of makeup, but he has he's a good-looking guy. He has this resonant voice that – you know, just has this kind of oily tone to everything he says. And it's just the perfect – and the first time you see him, if you've never even seen a Deep Space Nine episode before and have no idea who Gul Dukat is, you think, that guy's a bad guy. But he's not like chewing on the scenery bad guy. It's just like, yeah, he's unstable and you should not trust this guy.
Yeah. And immediately you start seeing him interact with Kira, who is one of my favorite characters in DS9. I think the actress who plays her did a really good job. I mean, just throughout, from the very beginning, I always thought that that character was well played. And those two have like this relationship. In fact, I don't want to spoil it, but later in the episode, they have a scene together, which is probably one of the best scenes in the episode, in my opinion.
Yes.
And so you've got Kira and Gul Dukat, and then they cut to, I believe at that point, they cut to Quark. Mm-hmm. And everybody's talking about, oh, this is terrible. And Quark says, hey, you know what? The trains run on time, you know, basically, right? You know, and he makes a point, you know, he's like, hey, everything's under control more or less. And that's Quark, you know, it's not the terrible one-dimensional Quark of the first series, but the one that has developed by the time you get to series 6. Right.
And because he makes a point, he says, you know, I think Odo asks him, what do you want, Quark? And he says, you know, peace, love, and understanding, and profit. And the first season, Quark, I think, would have just said, stop there, and been happy that profits seem to be coming back because people are coming back to Deep Space Nine, which is now back, I guess, Technor or whatever his name is. Because the Cardassians have once again occupied, the Dominion have occupied the Deep Space Nine. Although the Dominion, don't call it an occupation, because they're Bajor's friends, which is another kind of subtle thing about Deep Space Nine. But anyway, Quark says, you know, Kira's like, I can't believe you, you disgust me. And Quark has this great little moment where he's talking about, well, Kira, do you see any ghetto fences in the promenade? Do you see children starving? Do you see Bajorans collapsed on the deck because they're exhausted from working? I don't. I'm just saying it could be a lot worse. And I thought that was a really good moment with Quark.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't mention in, you know, I forget how you pronounce his name.
Wayun.
Wayun, yeah. He's just so slimy. once again, it's a great actor, and he just really does a good job.
I think that it is a genius pairing to have Gul Dukat and Wayun together because they are both clearly untrustworthy and bad guys, but in so many completely different ways that it just makes it fascinating to watch.
And every scene, Gul Dukat looks like he wants to just pound Wayun into a puddle of goo. He knows he can't.
And it just angers him so much.
Yeah.
And he thinks – see, Gul Dukat thinks that he's in charge, but he is clearly not in charge. And it's that there's another scene where Wayun and Gul Dukat are talking, and because Wayun has just given the Jem'Hadar, which are warriors that fight for. I guess I should kind of explain what the Dominion is for people who may be watching this episode for the first time ever and don't know. The Dominion, they're from another part of the galaxy. They are run by the Founders, which are the shape-shifting aliens of which Odo is one of, and they have various races that kind of serve their needs. Weyoun is a Vorta, and the Vorta are kind of clones that are basically the bureaucracy and the leaders for their armies, I guess.
Yeah.
And their armies consist of these other genetically engineered warriors called the Jem'Hadar. And the interesting thing about the Jem'Hadar, they're kind of one-note characters, killing machines. But they don't eat, they don't drink, they only subsist on something called Ketracel White, which they can only get from the Founders. And if they don't have any Ketracel White, which is an important plot point for this episode, they die. And so the Ketracel White is life for them. And in fact, they have this little ceremony where Vortas give Jem'Hadar Ketracel White, and Ketracel White, the Jem'Hadar say, you know, long live the Founders and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
Which I always found that interesting, that interplay with those people.
Yeah. Just the whole, whoever came up with all of that, it was a great kind of dynamic. Although it's funny because Weyoun is like, he's so obsessed with pleasing Odo, I guess, which comes out in this episode. And It's just a weird thing, but I guess you could see it. It's just bred into them, in essence.
He is genetically engineered to be obsequious to Founders' wishes, because the Founders are gods.
So then, Sisko and the Defiant and his ragtag fleet get back to a starbase, mm-hmm. and he's immediately told, "You're relieved of command." And I'd forgot about that. I'm like, "Oh man, what is he going to be on another space station?"
Shipping him home,
you know. And then there's a great scene where he talks to his dad, and like I was saying earlier, I do like the interplay with his family, and I totally forgot that he left his son on the space station.
That's right.
I'm like, that's like the dumbest thing. I remember back when the show was on, how, why did that happen? But anyway, that happened in the show.
And to be fair to Sisko, Jake Sisko, who is his son, wanted to stay on the station because he wants to be, or he is, I suppose, a journalist, and he wanted to stay there to write about the occupation and to send his reports back to Starfleet News or whatever, whoever you read on there.
And how come they never made him like a golden hostage?
that is a good question.
I mean, because it's like, how much control could you have over Sisko if you say, look, we got your son here, buddy. Those mines, we need a code.
That's right. Or Jake gets thrown into one of those mines.
Yeah.
But they don't, I guess. I don't know why, but they don't. But yes, so they and that is a great scene with Sisko's father. And of course, Sisko's father owns a restaurant on Earth, and that's always fun. And he talks about, you know, how he hasn't poisoned anyone for a couple days.
And gumbo and all that.
Yes, exactly. He's kind of like, well, why don't you just come back to home? Don't do what they tell you to. And Captain Sisko's like, I go where they tell me to. I'm a Starfleet captain. That's not the man you raised. And he has a great line where he's like, well, I raised you to be a cook, and look how that turned out.
Yeah. And then, you know, having talked about Jake, they go back to the space station. And one of the best scenes of this episode was the scene where Weyoun and Jake are talking. And Jake doesn't understand why they won't publish anything he's writing. And Weyoun is like masterfully explaining how he, you know, manipulating this kid to write stories that are favorable. And yes, I thought that was, I mean, there's not a whole lot to say except – just the way that was played was so subtle. It was nice.
It reminded me of many conversations I've had with trained public relations people.
Yeah,
that's their job. They need to massage you and try and get you to write the story from their side.
Yeah,
and that's what Weyoun is doing. And there's a great line where Jake is like, well, what about the freedom of the press? After Weyoun is like, well, I'm not going to let you publish your stories. And Weyoun's like, please don't tell me you're that naive.
Yeah, exactly.
And Jake has this kind of befuddled look on his face when he suddenly realizes he is on an occupied space station.
Maybe full of people with guns.
Yes, maybe he's made a
mistake. Ketracel White.
Yes, they're hopped up on Ketracel White.
But then they don't make you wait. They tell you, okay, we go back to Starfleet, and Sisko's not getting shipped out. He's getting put on a ship belonging, a Dominion ship, and they're going to send him to blow up the big cache of Ketracel White.
That's right. They have captured, in a previous episode, they captured a Jem'Hadar ship. Actually, Sisko and the Defiant captured one. And so they've got it at the starbase, and they're going to put the crew of the Defiant on the ship and send them off to blow up this cache of Ketracel White in deep in Dominion territory. or I guess Cardassian territory, which is, I guess, the same now, right? And so that leads us to many entertaining scenes where the Federation crew try to figure out how to pilot a Jem'Hadar ship. But it doesn't, like, devolve into, like, a super zany montage of things blowing up or, you know, them pressing the wrong button and getting water poured on them or something. Yeah. Which it could
have. Ketracel White.
Yes, exactly. But there's a scene where, you know, like, what's his name? What is Nog?
The son of Quark.
Yes. Yeah. He's like, why are there no chairs? And O'Brien's like, well, it wasn't designed for that. But it also doesn't – you haven't noticed it doesn't have any food replicators.
Yeah.
And Jadzia Dax is like, well, there's no viewport. And then Bashir comes in and he's like, well, there's no sick bay.
I forgot how much I liked Bashir. I just like that character. I don't know what it is. I have a man crush on him.
Now, what do you have a man crush on post genetically engineered reveal, Bashir?
Yeah, he seemed very comfortable in his skin.
Yes, he was always, before they revealed this, which I also don't think they planned, he always seemed a little uneasy as a character.
Yeah.
But he has certainly, now that he can be as genetically engineered and superior as he is, he has settled into doing very difficult math in his head very quickly.
Yeah, that they established it like 8 times.
Yes, they do. Which might have been a bit much, but.
But then we get back to Deep Space Nine, and you have the scene where Kira sits down, you know, with the oppressor, and they have this conversation. It's just so good on so many levels between Dukat and Kira.
Dukat is so creepy and so delusional.
Yeah. And he talks about how they already have a relationship, and she's like, what are you talking about? And she's getting so angry, and I don't know. I thought that scene – I just got lost in that scene. I thought it was great.
It was a great scene, and also the fact that he is fiddling around with Sisko. So he's in Sisko's office, and the baseball is still there, and he's fiddling around with that, and then he's trying to convince Kira that they have this deep, abiding relationship and that she will eventually see that – Dukat is only doing what's right for Cardassia, as he always says, and that Kira is going to come around at some point. It was a very good scene, well acted, and Kira was having none of it.
Yeah, that was a great scene. And then you go back to the Jem'Hadar ship, and Sisko's going into Jem'Hadar territory, and he gets fired on by one of his pals. From Starfleet. It's like, don't you think somebody could have told them? But I guess not. And I thought that was really forced. They have this scene where he doesn't, do we fire back at my friend, or do we let it, you know, we let it go? And I don't know. That just kind of drug on for me. It didn't seem that difficult. But I guess they had some great special effects they wanted to use, and so they did.
Yeah, and I didn't think that ship looked all that great either. So I kind of was like, it's an interesting idea, right? They're trapped in this situation where their comm system is broken, so they can't say, hey, don't shoot us. So they have this dilemma of, do we shoot or do we not? And, I mean, it seems like you would just disable his weapons, and then hope that he goes away. And he does, because a bunch of other Jem'Hadar ships come, although they didn't actually successfully disable his weapons, I don't think. But
yeah. And then they go back to Deep Space Nine. Actually. And then Odo, you know, who is a shapeshifter, he's a founder, and he goes back and uses his influence with Weyoun to get them to allow them to bring their own security back on, which – to me, it's like a foreshadowing. You know that's going to be a big deal later. That yes. He's got guys with guns on his ship as well. And they don't really say any more about it. But and that's also interesting how even Weyoun is kind of manipulating Odo a little bit, because he wants him on the council. Mm-hmm. And Odo thinks that he's helping, and Kira's like, I don't know about this, you know. And
I like that scene, because Weyoun, you know, we've seen Weyoun in a bunch of different scenarios at this point, right? He's been interacting with Jake, where he was totally in control. He's interacting with Gul Dukat, and he was totally in control. But his as soon as Odo comes in, his whole manner changes, and Odo's like, I want my Bajoran soldiers back. And he's like, that shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah.
I want them to have their weapons. Great.
Yeah, exactly.
But then he says, just like you said,
I'd like you to turn around 3 times while rubbing your tummy and patting your head. Got it.
Done. Yeah. But then he can't. The Weyoun has to manipulate. So he's like, I've done something for you, so why don't you do something for me, Odo?
Yeah.
And that's when he kind of gets him to be on this council to kind of give legitimacy to the occupation of Deep Space Nine. At least that's what Kira thinks, and I think Kira is actually right. And Odo's like, but no, this is like a victory, right? And Kira's like, it doesn't feel like one.
Yeah. And then it starts really moving fast, because then they go back to Jem'Hadar space and the action scene shows up where they get in with the Jem'Hadar ship. And so they've got a transfer mechanism where it's kind of interesting. These vessels that you put the white in must be very valuable because they have to get the old ones back.
That's right. They have, you know, or you don't get your deposit back. That's the problem.
It's like, you know, you have all this space. You could actually just eject those as you finish them, but no, they want them back. So,
and they can they can turn matter into energy and vice versa. So they could just make them.
Yeah, they could melt them down and turn them into a taco or something.
But exactly.
Instead, they want them back. So, but that's convenient because it allows O'Brien to load one up with, you know, Acme style TNT, and they beam the empty vessels back and get new ones with white in them. And then they don't really explain why, but suddenly the shield goes up and and they're not able to escape, even though they've basically planted a bomb on this asteroid
with a 1.5 minute timer on it.
Yeah.
Because their plan was, we'll set the timer, then we'll leave, and the place will blow up, and we'll be fine. But now,
the faster the timer, the less likely they are to capture it. I got that part.
Right, but they're stuck for some reason in the shield because they turn the shields on.
Yeah, and there's no communications, and I felt like the story could have done a better job of making that happen without being.
Just doing it.
Exactly. I mean, or even just say, hey, what the heck is this? This is, or I don't know. But so they rather artificially create the situation where the ship is stuck inside the force field. The bomb's about to go off, and they realize the only way they can escape is in the seconds between the bomb going off to knock down the force field generator, but before the explosion reaches their ship, which to me makes no sense at all. But if only they had someone who was a superhuman and could calculate, how many seconds it takes.
I think you're forgetting about someone.
Oh, wait a second. You're right. Bashir.
That's right. He calculates that it will take, 1.3 seconds.
Yeah. And then they hand it off to the computer, and then the bomb goes off anyway. but they don't die. But
they do a lot of intricate setup for something that actually doesn't work out at all.
Yeah. I guess the writer's idea was we want the ship to break because that leads into the next episode. Right. But boy, the way they went about doing it to me is really goofy. I felt like if I spent 10 minutes thinking about it, I could have come up with a better way to do that.
Yeah, or at least like thrown in a line of dialogue about why the shields came up instead of just making the shields come up. Or actually having them like challenge them and saying, wait a second, there's something wrong with this, and then it blows up or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
But they didn't do that. And then that's the big reveal at the end. They do survive, but their warp core, or warp matrix, I suppose, because this doesn't have a warp core, is offline. And then Garak, who is another great character, says, excuse me for my ignorance, but if we don't have warp drive, how long will it take us to get back to the closest Federation starbase? And that's where Dr. Bashir and his amazing calculating machine comes in and says...
I wrote this down. 17 years, 2 months, and 3 days, give or take an hour.
Which is a long time. And there are no food replicators on this ship, so they could just die of starvation.
That would be a heck of a
and that's how Deep Space Nine ends.
Yeah. Except for the way they did the explosion at the end, I thought this was a good episode.
Yes, I think that this is a good episode, and it really made me want to watch the next 5 episodes in this story arc, which I didn't do because I didn't want to mix it up as we were talking about this episode.
Yeah.
Because I'm a simple man. I can't keep more than one episode.
Also, if you're watching with your wife, you got to wait and watch them with her.
That's true, because in this episode, Worf and Jadzia are a couple, and she was like, what? What's going on?
Yeah, exactly.
So there's a lot we need to get through before we can get back to this.
This series, in hindsight, really had some great characters. I think I'm going to have to go back and watch it again, too.
I think you should, because these characters – I mean, it has some characters that I don't really like. Later on, like Vic Fontaine, I think, the holographic lounge singer that comes up a lot in later episodes. I could do without, but –
That's okay. What was the comedian that they used to put on Next Generation.
Oh, yes. I can't think of his name, but trying to teach Data how to tell jokes. Yeah,
it's like, boy, you guys didn't need to do that.
Yes, that was...
They should have thrown him out an airlock along with, with Riker's trombone.
I agree. Next on Random Trek, Enterprise Season 2, Catwalk.